I want you to join me back in Numbers chapter 35, and I want you to go to verse number 16, which we've already read a little bit of this, but contextually it helps us to start back here again. We've just finished with Moses passing on information from God to the Israelis regarding the inheritance sections of the Promised Land amongst the various tribes, and how the Levitical tribe is going to be scattered in Levitical cities all over these different tribes, and how there will also be six cities of refuge that belong to the Levitical tribes, three on one side of the Jordan Valley, three on the other side. And the reason for the Levites being scattered like that is because they are going to be the ongoing source of information about the law. They will be the judges, the judicial arm of Israel, to make sure everything is done in accordance with the law. Now, that's the goal, unfortunately, that we'll discover as we continue in the history. That was not always the case. But that's a story about sin. And we'll get to that. But here we have the precepts, the principles. So the idea here is that every death that might be considered murder by the local authorities, the person who did the death, did the killing, has the right to run off to one of the six cities of refuge for a change of venue trial. The six cities of refuge, always one of them within a day's journey of anywhere in the land of Israel. And so it's readily accessible. So once they get to the city of refuge, then here are some of the guidance rules given by God through Moses to the Levitical judges, the priestly judges perhaps, regarding the death and how they should determine if it was on purpose or worthy of being a capital crime, or was it manslaughter. And so the first thing that is supposed to be taken into consideration is the item used to cause the death. Would a reasonable person expect that getting whacked with this would end in death? Okay, verse 16. If he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he's a murderer. The murderer should be put to death. Nobody should have to think twice about this question. If I bang somebody up against the side of the head with something made of metal, will they die? The answer is, very possibly. All right? Everybody should understand that and not do that. Verse 17, if he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death and he died, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. If I have an axe made of or a hammer made of a big stone attached to a wooden handle, would a reasonable person understand whacking somebody upside the head with that is going to kill them? Yes, they should understand that. And so you shouldn't be doing it. Verse number 18. Or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death and he died, he's a murderer. The murderer should be put to death. Now, not all wooden tools, implements, could cause death. Being whacked upside the head with a stick is not necessarily going to cause death, depending on how big the stick was and things of that nature. But if it were sharp and pointy and you stabbed at him with it, that'd be pretty clear-cut understanding that this is a lethal weapon. Okay? So that's the sort of thing that they're supposed to be taking into consideration as judges. Now, verse 19 reminds us that there is an agent of the hometown government the council of elders, if you will, that has been dispatched to track down and bring justice of the court against this killer. His title is the Avenger of Blood. Verse 19, the Avenger of Blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. So he has been authorized by a court in the hometown area where the death occurred to track down and execute a murderer, because that's the finding of the local court. However, if the person who committed the death runs off to the city of refuge, he has a right to a change of venue trial before judges who can listen to both sides of the story and determine whether or not the home court, that is, the home council, was correct in their finding. Or were they acting hastily out of emotion? So it's an appeals court, if you will. Eventually, if the appeals court, the City of Refuge court, agrees with the lower court, the home council court, then the killer is handed over to the Avenger of Blood, and he either executes the guy on the spot or takes him back to the hometown for execution. And that's all legit. That's all above board. It's all according to the law. That's justice, not vengeance. Now, the next section starts talking about what about circumstances that you need to take in consideration. Verse 20, and if he pushed him out of hatred or hurled something at him lying in wait so that he died, so he intentionally was trying to kill this guy, lying in wait so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, like choked him to death or something of that nature, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. So if it was intentional, then that's a pretty clear-cut murder charge. The Avenger of Blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But, verse 22, now this is where the exceptions start coming in. Very important for the judges, and also very important for someone that has accidentally killed someone to have the right for their case to be heard by the appeals court at the City of Refuge, where there is no emotion. It's just the facts sort of approach. Verse 22, if he pushed him suddenly out of without enmity or hurled anything on him without lying in wait, meaning this just popped up suddenly and he shoved the guy and the guy lost his footing and fell against the wall and cracked his head open and died, or maybe they were, you know, working on a construction site. We're actually going to see something like that, and somebody got knocked over the side, or somebody was down below, and they end up with material dropping on their head and killing them. We're talking about true accidental deaths, okay? Verse 23 says, or used a stone that could cause death, and without seeing him, dropped it on him so that he died. That's the construction sort of site thing. Though he was not his enemy, didn't seek his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the Avenger of Blood in accordance with these rules. And there's other rules earlier that we talked about. We'll see more later in the book of Deuteronomy with repeats. The congregation here is not like the whole town. It's not the whole City of Refuge getting together in council and hearing this. It is likely a jury or panel of Levitical or priestly judges. That's who's probably hearing this. And they have to make the determination, verse 24, between the manslayer, the guy that caused the death, and the Avenger of Blood, who's been dispatched to execute the guy in accordance with these rules. The congregation shall rescue the manslayer from the hand of the Avenger of Blood, and the congregation will restore him to his city of refuge to which he has fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. Now, this is an interesting component in all of this justice. Obviously, the guy that caused an accidental death can't go back home because the people there felt so strongly about the death that he caused that they sent the Avenger of Blood after him. So he's not going to be going back there because there's a lot of hard feelings. And he can't just wander all over the place because the Avenger of Blood might feel that he's got a technical right to execute him based on the death warrant back in the hometown. So the guy is basically going to have to serve a detention sentence inside the boundaries of the Levitical city, the city of refuge, which, remember, it's the walled city and then like a 1.5 mile square around that city that belonged to the priests and the Levites. And so that's city of refuge territory. So he has to just basically serve out his sentence there. They mention here the death of the high priest, which most of the time, high priests live a good long time. So this is a multi-year sentence in most cases. My guess is, if you've got a high priest that lives only a short period of time after one of these cases is settled, the court at the city of refuge might meet again and say, you know what, your sentence of being under city arrest, detention, we're going to extend it into this new high priesthood because you should not be leaving while the Avenger of Blood is still looking for you. So the idea here is that even though it was an accident, there was still, more than likely, some lapse of consideration of safety for the other person, for the life of the other person. And that's serious. That needs to have some sort of penalty attached to it, some sort of period of time for the person to consider how badly they impacted on the lives of the people of that love that person that they killed. Now, we know from other passages that there are also supposed to be remuneration that takes place in these cases, besides the detention at the city of refuge. So all of that should be in the mix here. This guy doesn't get off scot-free, ever, because that would not be fair. Verse 26, if the manslayer should at any time go beyond the boundaries of his city of refuge to which he fled, and the Avenger of Blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the Avenger of Blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. For he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. That's going to be dicey no matter when he goes back. These things shall be for a statute and rule for you throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. So that is kind of a little view of justice here in the promised land. Verse number 30. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the evidence of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. So you can't have capital punishment when there's only testimony from a single source. There have to be at least two independent sources, and those sources have to agree, or there can't be a finding of a capital crime. That is justice in this justice system. Now, I know it's frustrating for a lot of people that that means a few people might get away with their crime because they just didn't get seen. Well, the Jewish law also includes the ability of judges to evaluate other evidence beyond eyewitness territory and come to a conclusion as to whether or not someone was guilty. So in that way, it is similar to our own system where personal eyewitness testimony is augmented by forensic evidence. And in the case of the Israelis, by the way, they always had access to the high priest and the Urim and the Thummim as a final appeal as to whether or not a person was guilty of a capital crime. Verse number 31, continuing. Moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be put to death. So the guy can't try to buy his way out of a capital crime. You shall accept no ransom from him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the high priest. So he can't get out of his detention period by paying people off. That would not be fair. Verse 33, you shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. Now that is an allusion back to the book of Genesis, chapter number 9, where God put capital punishment in place for humanity for the very first time. It goes something like this. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God, he has been made. So, murder of a human being is an insult of the Creator God himself. And therefore, it has a detrimental impact upon the community in which that crime occurs. And in this case, the imagery is that the land is polluted by that blood of the person that died seeping down into the ground and crying out for justice. You might remember back in the book of Genesis as well, the very first manslaughter, accidental death, was when Cain killed Abel. And when God confronted Cain, he said, where is your brother Abel? And Cain's response was, am I my brother's keeper? It's not my day to watch him. And God's response to that was, his blood is crying out to me from the ground. And of course, the justice in that case was expulsion from agriculture. Cain was no longer allowed to till the land and harvest the land. He had to wander. That was his detention punishment, to have to never stay in one spot for very long, making fields of grain. And so all of this kind of plays together. Always keep everything from Scripture together to understand the principles that we're coming across here. Verse 34, you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for For I, he who is, dwell in the midst of the people of Israel. So don't be bringing that stuff into my land. Don't be murdering people, killing people without thinking about them being made in the image and likeness of God, not taking proper care in how you interact with people. Don't be causing death in my land and in my presence, because that's not right. That's the message of God through Moses to the people of Israel before they ever go into the promised land. Now, all of this is in the larger context of dividing the land up into inheritance. And so that's why the next chapter, chapter 36, brings back to the forefront something we've already talked about. The heads of the fathers' houses of the clan of the people of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the clans of the people of Joseph, came near and spoke to before Moses, before the chiefs, the heads of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel. They said, "He who is commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel, and my Lord was commanded by he who is to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters." Now you remember, there was a guy that was on the original census list, but he died. He had no sons. So his male line was not represented on the second census list. And when his daughters complained about that to Moses, and Moses brought it to God, God said, "You're correct, that is not fair. If there is a situation like this that ever happens, then the inheritance will pass according to the female line for that one place in the inheritance line." And so now they've come up with something else that they're concerned about. Verse 3, "If they're married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the people of Israel, then the inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken away from the lot of our inheritance. And when the jubilee of the people of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry, and their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of the tribe of their fathers." So they're concerned because all these tribes have borders with other tribes, and, you know, people tend to marry people near them. So it's possible that someone from the tribe of Manasseh might end up marrying somebody from the tribe of Gad. Well, if it's one of those situations where the inheritance is supposed to follow the female line for one generation, it could end up still being transferred to a neighboring tribe. And these guys are basically saying, hey, that's not fair. That's not right. And so they are appealing for a decision from God on this. Verse 5. "Moses commanded the people of Israel, according to the word of he who is, saying, the tribe of the people of Joseph is right. This is what he who is commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best, only they shall marry within the clan of the tribe of their father." So the solution to the problem is, if this issue comes up, it's here with the Zelophehad girls. If it comes up at any time in the future where it's only females that are in the next generation, then those ladies must marry inside their own tribe. Specifically, they ought to marry inside their own clan, which is a subdivision of their own tribe, so that everything is kept in family locally. Now, that's going to solve the problem. "The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not be transferred from one tribe to another, for every one of the people of Israel shall hold on to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. Every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel shall be wife to one of the clan of the tribe of her father, so that every one of the people of Israel may possess the inheritance of his fathers." So no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel shall hold on to its own inheritance. And so the daughters of Zelophehad did as he who has commanded Moses. This is Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah. The daughters of Zelophehad were married to sons of their father's brothers. So they married in family, in clan. They were married into the clans of the people of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's clan. So problem solved, principle set. This is the way it's supposed to happen. Most of the people can marry any tribal person they want and not have this problem. But every once in a while, a little hiccup like this might happen. And so this is the way it's resolved. Now that finishes for us the book of Numbers, verse 13. These are the commandments and the rules of he who is that were commanded through Moses to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. That leaves us only with the book of Deuteronomy, which we're going to start next session. Book of Deuteronomy literally means second law. It is Moses' farewell address to the Israeli people. And as part of his farewell address, he reviews the events of the Exodus and the giving of the law. He restates many of the key points of the law, reemphasizes the things that he thinks are very important. And then he really does his best to make sure his students that he spent 40 years with have the best possible chance of being successful once they go into the Promised Land. So come back next time, and we'll get back into the Word.